Hi, welcome back with Truth News. Truth News Radio Australia is a homegrown production from the eastern sector of the global prison state, continent being Terra Australis. And of course, the country we live in had been a prison country for a large part of its history when the British decided that they needed to have some slaves so they could start colonising the other half of the world. They basically started arresting people for doing minor infractions, sentenced them to death, and of course then commuted that to life transportation, and that's how you create a country. You know, that's what we came out of. That's our history. That's our sordid, wicked, evil history. And, you know, people talk about the terrible things that we did to the Aborigines, but of course, and I wouldn't want to minimise that, but the things that the colonising, conquering empire did to its own people are no less egregious. And, you know, when we see the Royal Jubilee celebrations, which have been constantly on the news here for the last 3 or 4 days, absolutely sickening display of, you know, infatuation with these parasitic, you know, vestiges of some disgusting power elite who really just held the world, you know, just by force and ransom and threats for hundreds or thousands of years. And here we see everyone still, you know, goggle-eyed before them, carrying on with their silly pageants. Anyway, that's how I begin shows now. What did you think of that rant?
I liked it. Look, I just wanted to give some examples of, sure. You know, people that grew up in poor families that, you know, really became, you know, I mean, you had J.K. Rowling, for instance, was very poor before she wrote Harry Potter. Under New Zealand law, dead before she could even write the book.
Well, yeah, she was on benefits. I mean, she'd be forced on contraceptives, and then if she didn't behave herself, she could, you know, yeah, have her reproductive rights stripped.
Or her mother, you know, would have been, you know, she would have been stripped from her mum. Eminem, you know, Marshall Mathers, he came from a very poor family. Dolly Parton, Charles
But, of course,
Bronson.
The fact is a lot of people do abuse their kids. We don't deny that. Do we? I mean, it is horrendous when people abuse their kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not saying that people, you know, I think there should be, it's a very, very complex issue, but to step in straight away and say, we have the right to sort of deal with unborn people that haven't even been born yet, to almost, almost do a preemptive strike, if you will, onto unborn people. I mean,
It's a raw power grab from the people who run the government. And it'll be any government. It won't matter whether it's left or right. They're all in on it. They all benefit from this, right? Including the public servants. And a lot of the people who administer this are just public servants. And, of course, a lot of the child protection workers are people with, you know, even criminal histories. Quite a lot of them are people with severe abnormalities, these people who are actually in charge of caring for children. That's why you have so many bad things happen to kids when they're in foster homes. And about 50% of the kids in foster homes are on some form of psychiatric medication, which again is just, you know, a sign that the people who are running these systems are out of control, are just intoxicated with their power. And in the US, I should also point out, it's been proven that drug companies were doing tests of experimental drug treatments on kids in foster homes. And they were doing this with AIDS drugs, and they were also doing it with pesticides. I mean, that's just beyond your – it just blows my mind to even consider that. And it's tragic. I mean, it really is heartbreaking. But this is what happens when you start giving the government more and more power and just saying, yes, protect us, make us safe. Here's more power. Yes, we bow down before you to make us safe. This is what happens. Now, Josh, I've got a clip I really want to play because it's actually a video from Australia made by a video production company called Kuzu, who's been specializing in actually doing very powerful short videos that highlight issues of social importance. And it's also a commercial business that does a lot of other work. But they've actually been in touch with me directly, and they sent me a link to their latest promotional video. And I'll Great. Play it for you, and it's all about body scanners. So here we go. I'll play it. Of course, it's better if you watch the video version, which will be on our website. But I'll play the audio too because it's really worth listening to.
So yeah, this the video is sensational, folks. So check it out on truthnews.com.au.
Absolutely. Here we go.
I'm Roanna Ruiz for Civil Liberties Australia. On Christmas Day 2009, an unpassported, dazed and deranged 23-year-old Nigerian, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, was put on Northwest Airlines Flight 253 flying from Amsterdam to Detroit. He was sent off with an ineffective explosive down his trousers. Disturbingly, evidence has since emerged that he boarded the plane with official U.S. help. This means Abdulmutallab didn't act on his own accord. The end result of the Abdulmutallab incident is the introduction of Australian airport body scanners with a no-scan, no-fly policy. In short, everyone who flies from now on will automatically be suspected of doing the same as Abdulmutallab and will be deemed guilty until proven innocent. Arguably, this is the beginning of pre-crime approach to policing and security. Civil Liberties Australia says Australians must be given an airport body scanner opt-out provision, like Americans and Europeans who are given alternatives. The Australian opt-out should be on the grounds of medical, religious, or moral beliefs for those who believe electronic body searches or the danger of their health effects breach civil liberties. Critics like Civil Liberties Australia say it's a gross abuse of civil liberties, amounting to warrantless searches, and it's a grievous breach of human rights to travel without undue hindrance, when in fact, other workable options exist to maintain security and safety. Security-conscious Israel uses neither body scanners nor the controversial U.S. hand-down-the-pants pat-down, which is causing outrage in America. The Israeli Aviation Security Regulator, the Israel Security Agency, analyzes threats and vulnerabilities. It then provides guidance to airports and border crossings on how best to utilize technologies. Therefore, Israel is not scanning for liquids, and neither does it have to use body scanners nor the screening of personnel and crew. So what's going on in Australia? The nation is spending $28 million on body scanners and $200 million on the Strengthening Aviation Security Initiative. Critics of the body scanners say the staged Abdulmutallab incident was about selling fear as a pretext to justify the introduction of body scanners in the USA, Europe, and now in Australia. Sales of scanners have benefited the industrial security industry, generating huge profits, in the same way we now know the industrial military complex profits from wars. And so it is with Australians who are also being sold the same fear. Civil Liberties Australia say we're being made to pay for fear with our civil liberties, and it has to stop. It's important.
I'll just leave it there because you can get this off the website, and it goes for about 5.5 minutes. The thing I love about this is it's absolutely packed with information, right? And you can watch it a few times to really absorb it. But if you were to use this as a method of educating people, I think this would be really powerful. And if you were able to, for example, organize a meeting with a politician, someone you want to influence, use this, because this has all the information packed in, very clear, very easy to understand, and follows through all the key bullet points that you need to fully understand it. What do you think about it, Josh? What's your take on this?
I think it's very well done, the video. In fact, I think it's Kuzu, the company that you can basically go to and you pay them a little bit, and they make a whole news article, including over the shoulders, and you get a presenter and everything. And,
exactly. I mean, they're really an advertising company. You know, that's what they do, and they make promotional videos. But the person who runs it appears to have a social conscience, because they keep doing these videos, and they've got a whole bunch of them that they've done on some really important topics. Mm. And these appear to be a pro bono effort on their part. And
In terms, they said on religious grounds, and I went through which country was it? On the way through here, not this time around, but some other time I was traveling anyway. A lot of the Asian countries make you thumb scan.
Oh, yes.
When you go through security. And I just said, no, it's against my religion. And they sort of looked at me weirdly and they said, okay, you don't have to do it.
Well, and not in Australia. So, yeah. Religion's irrelevant here. They just throw you into the radiation bath and shut up, you know, like don't, you know, there is no opt out. It doesn't matter what your religion is. It doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter what you want. The government knows best. What's your take on that, George?
Well, it reminds me of the DNA grab in Australia where Australia wants to, and probably has, DNA'd everyone in the country. Now, I know in certain institutions, as I've been told and as I've witnessed, for example, in jails in Australia, all the prisoners were required to give a DNA sample. At the time that they were advised, I think this was a couple of years or 3 years ago. No, it's more actually, probably about 7 or 8 years ago. At the time that they were asked to voluntarily give a DNA sample, which was a mouth swab, they were all given this leaflet. And the leaflet was nicely written and said that they could appeal to a magistrate if they had religious or other objections to it. Well, of course, none of that occurred. And my understanding is that the inmates who did not comply with the mouth swab were actually wrestled to the ground with hair removed from their head. And that was used as a DNA sample. Any objections after that? Oh, no, they gave it voluntarily. So,
well, I can see the same thing happening in airports. I mean, it's not a big step to go from, you know, demanding that you go through the machine to demanding that you give a DNA swab. I mean, why do people don't realize that it's not going to stop at one thing? It's like the Holocaust. You know, if they're going to demand that you wear the Star of David on your sleeve when you walk out the door, do you think it's going to stop at that? And yet, George, I mean, you've got family who lived through the Holocaust. I mean, we've probably had too much Hollywood about all that. But the point is that the Jews did go along with those ridiculous demands and it didn't help them, did it? Like going along with it didn't work out for them too well, did it?
It doesn't work out to go along with government because government mutates its powers and it gets worse and worse. So today it's institutional inmates being DNA'd. Perhaps they may have been involved in some horrendous crime. I don't know if any such prosecutions ever came forward. And now you've got your scanner at the airport, and, of course, it will continue. I imagine that one day you may want to walk into a major shopping centre and ask to be scanned first. So I feel as though Eisenhower warned us about the industrial military complex. He called it the military industrial at that time. And there's a very good clip of him on YouTube concerning that little speech he made. Well, today we've got the industrial security complex, as Josh had mentioned. So I think that's really where it's coming from. And I think that the logic of government controlling us has really gone a little bit too far.
Indeed. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Please stay with us. We're going to have more in-depth discussion for the next 45 minutes with George Georges and Josh Jackson. I'm Harrywood Fenton. We'll be right back. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Welcome back. Truth News Radio Australia welcomes your continued patronage and presence, and we are going to dive now into a very deep rabbit hole with George Georges. As I indicated at the beginning of the show, George knows a lot about the criminal justice system around the world, but you know, particularly in this country. But much of what he knows will relate to other countries as well. And now, George, in our discussions, what prior to this, when we've talked about it, what's really struck me about it is that when prosecutors decide that they are going to nail someone to the wall, that this is nothing like the television version of reality we see, where we see the police and the law trying to find the bad guy, trying to prove that trying to do the right thing, so following procedure, and then getting frustrated. Always in those television shows, you know how they're always getting frustrated, how they've got to follow all these procedures, and if only we could just nail this guy, but we can't. We've got to have evidence, and they're always wringing their hands, how they've got to follow all these procedures, because we live in such wonderful democracies where you can't just throw people in a dungeon because you don't like them or you think they might be guilty. You've actually got to provide some evidence, and you've actually got to follow due process. You've got to charge them and go through all these annoying things and take them before a judge. And of course, the police and
if you're in Bali.
Well, yeah, it's different, not if you're in Australia either. Then that's the point. Okay, there's a television version of reality, and then there's reality. We could talk about Bali, but George, I mean, let's just go through what some of the things we can only, there's a tip of the iceberg here, right? But typically, when the justice system clicks in to saying we're gonna go after this guy, can you just run through some scenarios of how it works?
All right. Well, I'm in the process of writing a book for the last few years, as you're aware, Hereward.
Yeah.
And I've been fortunate enough to be able to get into the jail system and interviewed quite a few inmates, and being interested in the legal industry as I am.
Yeah.
As you know, I've managed to piece a lot of this material together, and some quite astonishing facts coming forward as far as a Western democratic just nation is concerned. And I've actually heard the phrase of, we don't know what he's done, but we know he's done something wrong. Well, that one left me on the floor for a short while, and then I got up and walked away. And then we had the situation in America where the FBI laboratory in America, after some years, I think a lady's name was Graham, who was responsible. I'm not sure. There was a Time story on it some number of years ago, where there was finally an admission that evidence was being prepared in the FBI laboratory there in Washington in order to satisfy the needs that police required in order to convict these criminals. In Australia, we've got a famous appeal case. It's the Griffith Pigott Simeon case. It's worth a read if anyone's into reading legal documents. And it concerned AGEL, the Australian Government Analytical Laboratory, which no longer exists. It was along the lines of the FBI fiasco that took place, where many, many innocent people were wrongfully convicted. In Australia, Griffiths, Pigott and Simeon were jailed for manufacturing drugs. It came out in the appeal, and let me tell you, there was a tremendous amount of effort involved, and a lot of lawyers were involved in this. It was a pivotal case for a number of reasons, but I won't go into the details of that, but it was a pivotal case. People from AGEL were cross-examined for a number of days in court, and it came out that they were manufacturing evidence to meet the requirements of police. So that appeal was won. And
did they end up working for the climate change people? just manufacturing evidence?
Well, I call climate change, I put it in the category of what I call junk science. And if you do some research on it, it's the usual suspects are involved. East Anglia University and the usual suspects are involved in that one.
Yeah, I thought maybe they might have been working for ACLS.
Well, they may have been. They may have been. And I've got junk science. There's other things I call junk economics. And unfortunately, we tend to suffer with these in our lives. But it's very wrong to go through a system where people are grabbed and locked away to make sure that the guilty are captured, rather than a system of it being more difficult in a genuine sense.
Well, this is the key point, isn't it? Is that the criminal justice system simply has to get runs on the board. They've got to tick boxes. And their whole system revolves around finding a guy who they can say did it, who then we can close that case and move on. And that's how they advance in their careers. That's how they say we're doing a good job. And if they get the wrong guy, well, they don't really care that much. And this is a fact. They just don't care. Even though if they get the wrong guy, they've committed two crimes. One is they've wrongfully punished someone. Secondly, they've let the real person go free who might go on to commit more crimes. So they've actually done a worse crime than just by doing nothing, by actually punishing the wrong person. It's an absolute insult to society to allow this to happen even once. But of course, there are so many cases of it. It's just staggering, isn't it?
Yes, in my interviews, I came forward with some very interesting information, and unfortunately, in this particular interview, I can't name names, and I'm sure that each of these.
Well, I can.
People...
I can name names. Let me give you a case here.
Well,
this is a case from Melbourne, and it was a story that I was following at the time. The man concerned is his name is Farah Jama. Well, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Now, he was convicted of raping a 40-year-old woman in the toilets of a suburban nightclub. And he was just a young man, and he had just finished his Year 12 exams at that point. The only evidence linking him to the crime was a DNA sample taken from the woman's rape kit. The woman had been found unconscious on the bathroom floor on a Saturday night in July of, I think it was a few years ago anyway, and this article is from 2009. So it was 2008. A forensic examination revealed that she had been raped. She later told investigators she had no recollection of Jama. She couldn't identify him and had not seen any men with black skin. No witness verification whatsoever. Jama had steadfastly denied the charge, and he'd said he'd never been to the nightclub. Not on that Melbourne night and not ever. He repeatedly stated that he was with his critically ill father on the other side of Melbourne. But the judge and the jury did not buy his alibi. Despite supporting evidence from his father, brother and his friend, instead they believed the forensic scientist who testified that there was a 1 in 800 billion chance that the DNA belonged to someone other than the accused man. Now, it all came apart later, after he was convicted and actually went to prison. Prosecutors finally admitted human error in the DNA testing on which the case was built, and his conviction was overturned. Prosecutors said they could not rule out contamination of the DNA sample after it emerged that the same forensic medical officer who used the rape kit had taken an earlier sample from Jama, from the suspect, in an unrelated matter. And they admitted a serious miscarriage of justice. But just think of the implications of that, because we put absolute faith in DNA evidence. And we've been taught on the television that it is like God. It's like the Delphic Oracle. It's been pronounced. It cannot be wrong. It's like Minority Report. You know that Tom Cruise movie? They cannot be wrong. We'll get right back into that. We're just going to break. Stay with us. With Truth News Radio Australia.
No more, no more. No more driver's license for me. Many thousand gone.
Hi, with Truth News, welcome back. We're talking about miscarriages of justice. Now, the case of Farah Jama, he spent 16 months in prison. I mean, he was lucky that he got out, you know. A lot of people have done a lot more time than that. Many of them have probably never got out after being wrongly convicted. The point I want to make, and I'll hand it over to you, George, but the point I would like to emphasize here is that this is a man who had some previous dealings with the police, okay? He'd done something wrong in the past, okay? Now, that's not disputed. And I believe this is the way the police work, is that they figure, well, we got some guy who did something bad. Even if he's not the right guy, he's some kind of bad guy. And they therefore feel totally justified in pinning the crime on someone because it clears the books, makes them look like they've done something, and they can justify it by saying, oh, you know, he was a crook or, you know, whatever. You know, even when they know that the guy's innocent, they somehow justify it to themselves like that. There's something like that going. What do you think, George?
One of the cases I've written up for my book, and I can't mention his name at the moment because it's still in consideration, is a fellow in New South Wales, in very similar circumstances, but actually having no contact with police prior, receiving a life sentence for a succession of rapes in New South Wales. Now, I can't mention the name because that will be up for appeal. But I was fortunate enough to be able to read some of the brief and some of the evidence, and I would hope that his lawyers were up to the task, because I have some suspicions about the actual initial conviction. And as you'd mentioned, Harold, it was a matter of statistics and cleaning up a few matters, and unfortunately this gentleman fell into that category. So the other problem which seems to arise is if someone wins on appeal and is released, then the case isn't reinvestigated because the guilty party was delivered to the courts and the courts released that person. That's a strange sort of logic that seems to come forward. So I don't know how this fits in with a system where we're required to maintain distant faith and credibility, but that's all we have, and we need to go with it and what it has. Perhaps it needs more checks and balances. Perhaps it needs a media that is not fully compliant, but actually questions. Perhaps we need, rather than journalistic prose following the government rhetoric, perhaps we need some real reporting in our mainstream media. There are many instances where there are doubts, but of course the court must decide. And the court makes its decisions based on the evidence which is presented. And,
but of course, when a person is standing trial, the prosecutors would like to do everything they can to make it difficult for that person to defend themselves. And again, that's against the principles of the justice system. It's not meant to be that way. You're meant to be considered innocent until proven guilty. But from my discussions with you, it appears that what actually goes on, and I'd like to get into some of the details here, of what happens, for example, when someone is put on remand after having been charged. Well, they're not guilty of any crime at this point. They've been charged, but the court can order that they basically have to go to prison on remand, as they call it. Now, that in itself, when you think about it, is a bit of a travesty of the concept of innocent until proven guilty. But people seem to have accepted that. It's been normalised, and we tend to think it's acceptable. That's that just because we think someone might be guilty, even though they're not convicted, we can stick them in jail. And they use arguments like, oh, there's a risk of flight and all this stuff. So I mean, George, from what your research, what's likely to happen to? I mean, let's take a different type of example. Let's say it's a businessman that's been charged with maybe some sort of corporate fraud, and it may be very important to be able to argue your case, to have access to all of the sort of information and lawyers that you would need to argue your case effectively. But what happens when such a man is actually put on remand in our justice system? What's it like?
Well, from my understanding, it's a very difficult adjustment because if the fellow is the person is classified as an alleged white collar criminal, then their criminality is regarded as of a high level and is thrown into a general population. The adaptation there is quite difficult, I understand. And someone convicted, it would take them several years just to adapt to that particular life. There are a lot of instances where there are problems. We had in New South Wales one particular fellow convicted of some oddity concerning, I think, about $300 worth of Qantas shares. I'll mention his name now. He's passed on, and the story is well known. Was Rifkin, and the fellow committed suicide after the events surrounding his white collar criminality. There are a lot of instances, and it seems to be.
And of course, he wasn't put on remand, but he was convicted and sentenced to a custodial sentence.
He was on a weekend detention for a while, and then the party started to get rough, and unfortunately, gentle fellow as he was, I don't know what else he was involved in his life. I interviewed him, I'd spoken to him a couple of times, and I felt that was rather an unfortunate thing. There was another situation with a director of one of the banks in Sydney. I won't mention his name. He unfortunately had some personal problems. He went to two trials and appeal, I believe, and exhausted all his personal funds, and then had difficulties with his superannuation with the bank that he worked for.
But George, what's it actually like for someone trying to fight their case? I mean, they're innocent till proven guilty. So, you know, they may well be innocent. You know, we don't know yet because the trial hasn't even begun. I mean, there are, you know, it starts off, there's charges. You go I presume someone goes before a court, and the court says, the prosecutors say, well, we think that this person is a risk. You're going to have to lock him up now. And then bail is usually sought and sometimes denied, or sometimes the bail is too high and they just can't pay it. And then, so what happens to an individual who is now thrown into the prison system but has to actually defend his or herself against, you know, a substantial court case?
Well, I remember the comments of one particular judge. I was sitting in court listening to a particular case, and the judge in this instance made a very good remark. There was a bit of an exchange between prosecuting barrister and the judge, and the judge said quite clearly and very strongly, the defence is entitled to all evidence before trial. And that was an argument concerning the alleged service of a brief on a remand inmate in Sydney concerning a major case, and the argument was whether or not the brief had actually been served or not. As it was, I followed through on that particular case because it was of particular interest at the time, and I realised that the brief that was actually delivered in the court and relied upon on speaking to two of the barristers from the defence side, I realised that the brief was actually different to that which was served on the person in jail. And in addition to that, the brief was regarded as a fire hazard in a couple of the prisons. Now, one of the destabilising elements, which
was utterly ridiculous, that's
of course, which I find quite insane, is that inmates are not kept in one particular prison. He was kept in one of the wings at Long Bay in Sydney, and then although the wing, my understanding is, was about a third empty, he was trucked on to Goulburn, and later it was said that he was lost in the system. But of course, he turned up again.
Can you just expand a little on the trucking of inmates?
The trucking, I understand, is quite horrendous, and we've had in Australia more than one death in trucking. I think in West Australia there were a couple, and a lot of sad events taking place. The trucking itself is horrendous. Going to and from court is horrendous. To really give a just outcome, apart from the concern of absconding or of continuing with a crime or such, really a person should be free to defend themselves, firstly. And secondly, I would suggest that if infrastructure considerations were brought to bear, then jails and the courts that handle these particular matters should be the same building, effectively, because the travelling is quite a horrendous exercise, which we can probably cover a little bit later.
Just hold on to those thoughts. We'll be right back for the final segment of the show. You're with Truth News. Stay with us. This is really important information. Do not go away. We'll be right back. Listening to Truth News. We're talking about the criminal justice system, but we're talking about the dark underbelly. Of course, I don't disagree that there are many cases where we feel that justice needs to be done. We feel that if a wrong has been committed, that something needs to be done, and a person needs to feel some, you know, to be put under pressure. That's what people feel is the purpose of prisons, is to make a person reflect on what they've done and not simply get away with it. But what actually goes on in prisons is so far beyond, I think, what people think about prisons, because we've heard a lot about, you know, inmates have their TVs and they have it too good, and we're paying all this money, you know, and it's too cushy in there. We've heard year after year, we've heard this in the news, and you know, the law and order saying, you know, they should be tougher and people should be locked up for longer and they shouldn't have privileges and all this stuff. Now, you know, from the research you've done, George, and from what I've gleaned, the situation of people in prisons is far, far worse than what anyone realizes. And we live in a country that supposedly is a country that is enshrined in human rights. And yet some of the things that are going on, I mean, we were just talking there in the last segment about what it's like just being on remand. And of course, you know, you described to me some of those details that you've gleaned, where, you know, prisoners will be constantly trucked back and forth for hours at a time, of course, from one place to another. And they're meant to be able to go to court every day, but they get them up at some ridiculous hour of the morning, and they make them sit in some stupid holding cell for hours at a time. Then they throw them on the trucks all shackled up. They drive them for several hours in one direction or another direction. They'll end up in some other little holding cell in the courts. They'll be crammed in a tiny room with far too many people for that room, with no air conditioning and usually, you know, one toilet that they have to ask permission if they can use. And this is someone who's supposed to be going to court, who has to be totally composed and able to present their case, because they might be fighting for their life. You know, they might be up against some horrendous sentence, you know, and they've really got to be totally focused on what they're doing, and they can't. They're put into a situation where they're mentally, emotionally, and physically destroyed in the process of simply attending a trial. Now, once they've been convicted, of course, the actual prison system itself. I mean, tell us a little bit about what you know about that, George. I mean, for example, killings that occur. Apparently, killings occur in prison quite a lot, and quite often they're not reported, never appear in the news, and no one even seems to know what happens to the guy who's suddenly dead. He's just gone.
I've interviewed far too many inmates over the years to doubt what my correct perceptions are of the industry and of being from being one of the other side of the fence. So from the many interviews I've conducted where there can't be any correlation there, my perceptions are reasonable. Now, if in New South Wales, a Nagel inquiry, for example, looked into the prison system and found some horrendous practices. That in itself is a very interesting read. A lot of those malpractices from the past were corrected, but of course new ones seem to creep in. The trucking of inmates, for example, from Silverwater, for example, where an inmate will be raised from his cell at 3:30 a.m., taken into a holding cell, changes into his court clothes if he wants to do that at the reception area, and sits in cells till about 8:30 that morning. Then they're bussed onto trucks and moved around the place, dropped off the different courts. There are groups who go in, as in I have spoken to people from Prison Fellowship as a Christian group, and confirmed many stories. And these people spend a lot of time voluntarily in the prisons around Australia and in the holding cells and talking to people, and they're very good Christian body. I found another particular Christian body much more better known than them, and my reports from this body are not very good. So it depends on the relationship and what happens. But the holding cells themselves, we compare ourselves as being better than other nations in, say, Southeast Asia or China or other non-humanitarian categorized countries. But I do believe it when an inmate tells me that he slept on concrete slabs in Sydney, and where jails are overcrowded, unfortunately. Now, is that to do with an overzealous jail system, or we've got too many criminals at hand, or I don't know.
I'd imagine in a major jail like Goulburn Jail, they'd have hot showers and, you know, proper heating, wouldn't they, in winter?
Oh, no, my understanding is that it's not a very pleasant environment down there, where you've got the shared showers on the outside of the yard areas. They're risen up about 6:30 in the morning, put into yards.
Goulburn, of course, gets regularly below zero. I mean, it's a very chilly place, similar to Canberra in terms of temperature.
I understand that if you would need to wear a couple of sets of clothing and sleep in your clothes for a week or so. And the showers, of course, with cold water at winter time is not, I don't imagine, would be quite a pleasant experience. The hot water is, I understand, is in the remand areas and also towards the end of sentences with where the classification changes. But during the intermediate periods there, I understand it's all cold. And
really, access to hot water depends on your classification.
Yeah,
so is this a form of punishment? Like if you're classified as a violent offender, you don't get to have a hot shower. Is that how it works? Or?
Well, if you've got an A2 or A1 classification, which is one regarded as a tendency towards violence, and the crime itself dictates that, then you'd be housed in, say, Goulburn, for example. And if you're on remand, you might be in the Silverwater or some area in the Long Bay. If you're being released, then you'd be put into a C classification, and then you'd have perhaps you'd get your TV and a hot water jug, and you might be able to get some hot water. But the showers, even it's interesting that the showers in the remand centre in Silverwater are just 6 minutes. So you've got 6 minutes of hot water there, and that's once a day. And if there are two people in the cell, then there has to be, I understand, some delegation go to the office to require a switch to be turned on and off, so a further 6 minute shower can be taken. And the return truck journey, of course, back into the Silverwater from the 3 a.m. rise, ends up in holding cells, and you probably, I understand, trotting back down to your cells about 11 o'clock that night, ready to fight for your life the next morning at 3:30. And pens are interesting because I see in court where inmates are coming in from remand areas and they don't have any pens because they're classified as a weapon. And their paperwork is taken and put into the boot of the truck and delivered to them.
Well, that just seems to me a form of sheer bastardry. Because, I mean, obviously...
I tend to agree with
the person who's charged, I mean, whether or not they've been charged with a violent crime, of course, has some relevance here. I mean, I guess if they've been charged with a stabbing crime, maybe having a pen might be considered a danger. But, I mean, what if it's someone who's charged with some, you know, white-collar thing? Oh, he can't have a pen because he might stab someone? I mean, that obviously is ludicrous, and it's obviously not a real threat. It's not a real danger. But it's like they don't want the person concerned to have a pen, because that would empower him a little. That would actually help him win his case. It would just give him the tools that he might need to be able to conduct his case. And it seems, and this is why the whole point of what we're talking here today seems to be that the system is just geared about getting convictions. It's geared about stripping people of their rights while providing a veneer that they still have those rights, but stripping everything away. And that then completely undermines what the justice system is supposed to be about, justice. It's actually supposed to be about justice. It's supposed to be fair. Otherwise, you might as well go back to a feudal system, or, you know, just throw people in dungeons. The king can order someone thrown into a dungeon for any reason he likes, just because he's angry, you know. And, you know, that is the reality. But we have a system that is equally sort of imperious in the way it behaves, except it's not so much the king, but there are many little kings. There are many little puffed up people in charge who will decide your fate, someone else's fate. And once they get you in their sights, you're in big trouble, because they're just going to bring you down. And that's what they want to do, is bring you down.
Unfortunately, that's very true. And there is a movie called In the Name of the Father, which is loosely
movie.
Based
yes.
on the Guildford and Birmingham wrongful convictions. Worth a look.
And also that Hurricane, the great movie about Reuben Hurricane Carter.
Unfortunately, it's not just a problem with Australia, but there seems to be something with the English legal system. I must read another book on that, I think.
Absolutely. Well, George, we've only just scraped the surface here, and I want to get more into these subjects with you in future shows. I know you've got a lot of knowledge, and we want to just basically gnaw away at what we can, and hopefully we get some feedback. If anyone out there is interested more in this, get in touch with me. Truth News Radio Australia, we'll be back next week. It's been absolutely fantastic speaking to you today. I look forward to it again next week. See you then.